Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another ChrisMartinson.com podcast. I am, of course, Chris Martinson, and today we're speaking with David Morgan, publisher of the Morgan Report on Precious Metals and proprietor of SilverInvestor.com. David's a longtime expert on the precious metals markets and how they operate, and actively consults for investors, hedge funds, mining companies, depositories, and bullion dealers. Today, we're going to talk with him about manipulation in the precious metals markets. Does it truly exist? And if so, where and to what extent? And what are the implications for buyers and holders of gold and silver today? David, we're privileged to have you here with us today.
Well, thank you. I'm pleased to be with you.
Well, listen, I'm really pleased to have you here today, and very interested in your views on, in particular, silver, of course, naturally for you. And the first thing I'd like to start with, you know, there's a lot of talk out on the internet, on my blog, at other blogs, all over the place, where people are wondering what's going on with the silver market. Is it a free and fair market? I guess, you know, this could be the larger precious metals markets. Maybe it might be the commodities markets people are concerned about. But with your experience and what you've seen, you've been looking at the silver market for a long time. Tell me how you think that the market currently is constructed and whether you think it's free and fair.
Okay, well, it's definitely not a free market in the true sense of the word. And it is manipulated, but probably not to the level that a lot of people consider it to be manipulated. This question comes up fairly often, and one of the most recent times it came up in a very large public forum was at the Silver Summit in 2009. And at that Silver Summit, this was actually a creation of mine and one of the mining guys in the Silver Valley that's fairly close to where I live in Spokane. The Silver Valley is in the Coeur d'Alene Mining District in Idaho, and I'm about an hour and a half from there. Anyway, we started the Silver Summit several years ago, and it grows every year. And 2009 had a pretty good turnout. I'm going to guess probably 800 to 1,000 people. And during one of the intermissions, Al Corlin, who has his own radio show, gathered us as the MC, us meaning myself, Bill Murphy from GATA, Roger Wiegand, Trader Raj, and Jeff Christian from CPM Group. And I believe that was it, those four. It might have been one more, and if I'm leaving someone out, forgive me. And Al wanted to get the debate going between manipulation and non-manipulation. So Murphy went first, gave, you know, the GATA position. And then Jeff Christian gave the CPM position, and then it was my turn. And I said, well, I'm in the middle, and I don't really want to be, you know, plan to be in the middle, but you cannot manipulate the overall trend of a market. The free market forces that remain are large enough to take a market higher or lower depending upon, you know, what the real market mm-hmm. forces are.
Yep.
The forces underlying the silver market are tremendously huge from two aspects, both industrial and monetary. And those forces have been shown from basically 2003 to present day, where you can really make the case that the manipulation that exists certainly takes place, and I'll explain that in a moment, but where you can really say that what is left of the free market really has an effect is from the advent of the ETFs in the silver market. If you look at what the silver price has done since April 2006, where the SLV was implemented, actually before that because there was some anticipation in the market, till present day, you'll see a huge increase, not only in the amount of physical metal purportedly bought by these ETFs, but the overall trend of the market price-wise, of course. So now back up, and so I said, again, to repeat myself, I think it bears repeating, that the overall trend in both gold and silver cannot be manipulated. All right. So what does that mean? Well, that means that what remains of the free market forces have influence, but within that main trend, the market is manipulated quite a bit. How often? I don't know. Daily, I doubt it. But I think there's some extreme cases, and I think it's good to look at the extreme cases, because if they can do it in an extreme way, they can probably do it in a subtle way as well. So one of the extreme cases was brought out, and I think, again, GATA probably did one of the best jobs of this, because I think they filmed a lot of this, of one of the traders, and I forget his name, but he talked about 25% of the world's silver market being sold in one mouse click. Now, anyone that knows anything about the way a market moves understands what he just said. And what he just said, all markets move based on buying or selling pressure. If there's more buying pressure, the price of whatever the commodity or the stock or the automobile or the Rembrandt painting, it doesn't matter. Whatever is being purchased will force the price higher because there's a lot of buyers that want to buy it. Conversely, if there's a lot of sellers selling something, the price will move down, be it a stock, be it a commodity, be it, you know, an abundance of Taurus automobiles. No one wants a Taurus anymore. There's lots of sales signs on them. So that's how markets move. So if you have a huge supply on paper of silver and you say to the market, I'm selling 25% of the world supply now, there is no way that that can't do anything but manipulate the price downward in a huge, huge way. Because if you understand commodities, and most people listen to these type of programs do, it is a zero-sum game. For every winner, there is a loser, and all orders have to match. And so that took the market down substantially, and that was brought out in the CFTC hearing. Chris, if you might, you might have a question or two, but I also want to give another good example of how the market is manipulated.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Okay, let's take the floor trading. Now, just to be very clear with everyone, the amount of floor trading that takes place on the commodities, in the commodities these days is rather small relative to the amount of what they call off-floor trading, which really means electronic trading. I mean, the amount of computer trading that goes on in these markets is huge relative to what is still done on the floor. But nonetheless, this serves as a very good example of how the price of silver actually operates pretty much from an objective perspective. And I want to emphasize the word objective because I have given this rendition, which is factual, many times, and it's always amusing to me the reactions I get. I did this actually for a bunch of Casey's researchers on a mining trip I was in Mexico, and there were about six of them, myself counting this number seven, and I'm going to give this out, but you know, three of them were convinced that proves without a doubt the market is manipulated, and the other three said, no, that's just how the market works. So here goes. And this really, really applied earlier on in the silver market. It still applies to some extent now, but the market has many more participants. As I said, the ETFs, more offshore participation, and you know, India has always been there, but China, there's just a lot more interest in the market. So the market's more diverse, which is good for any market. But regardless, here's how it works. So especially in the earlier days, you have, let's just say, two main parties. And this really is a good breakdown of it. You have, and Ted Butler, I'll give Ted plenty of credit here, has explained this many, many times. I don't know if he's explained it the way I'm going to, but he talks about the commercials or the banks, so they're the synonymous, and the trading funds. So I'm a trading fund, and I'm long silver, meaning I'm buying, I'm bullish, I think the price is going up. So I'm in the silver market, I'm buying. Well, there's buying pressure, and for every buy, there has to be a sell. So the banks are selling. So now, hypothetically, and you can look at a chart, but you can see the price when we broke out at 555, the price went up to 840. So there's all this buying pressure, and the market moves up. And the price is up, you know, roughly $3 from the breakout of 555. And now what happens is the trading funds have shot all their bullets. In other words, they have no more money available to them at all to put into the silver market. They bet at 550 and 575 and 6 and 625 and 650, and they're buying all the way up. And the banks are selling to them all the way up. But now there's several ways, but I'm just going to focus and keep it really simple. There's only one way for these trading funds, I hope I didn't say banks, but the trading funds buying all the way up, the banks selling all the way up. The trading funds have a huge profit on paper. The only way for the trading funds to get out of their position with a profit is to do what?
Sell their position.
Yeah. Absolutely. They have to sell. But since the banks were selling all the way up, I think the banks are going to buy at the top. They've been selling all the way up. They're going to sell on top of the trading funds. What's that called? Huge selling pressure. Huge. Hey, but wait a minute. All trades must match. So on the way up, some hedge fund decided that, you know, $7.20 looked like a really great price for silver, but they missed it. It opened at 7:40 the next day, and then it went to 7:60, and a few trading days later it was over 8, and then a few trading days after that was in the 8:30s and 8:40s. But they have an open order for $7.20. And so now they get their wish, because there are no orders that are open to buy silver except that order. And then you get what's called a gap down. They have to match. There's all these sells. The trading funds are selling. The banks are selling. Who's going to buy? And the answer is that lucky hedge fund's buying. So that's a gap in the chart. And that means that those 20 contracts that that hedge fund wanted to buy at 720 gets his wish.
Mm-hmm.
So it shows in the chart as a gap. And the reason I'm doing this and emphasizing it so strongly is I think that the extreme example is the best way to illustrate the point so perfectly clear that there's no ambiguity for anybody listening, Chris, to your show. Because I want it to be well understood. I want people to understand how these markets work, and I want it to be unambiguous, or, you know, where it's unquestionable what really takes place. So then you can take that same scenario a little further. There might be some people saying that are on the floor that's themselves that said, geez, we just had a $1.20 gap down. I think it's going to bounce. So the locals is what they call them, come in and buy, or maybe somebody saw it and said, that can't be, you know, whatever. So the market starts to get more participants, and there's more fresh orders that come in and that kind of thing. And then maybe some of the banks say, well, geez, we just, you know, shot it down $1.20. Maybe we could, you know, get rid of some of our shorts in the eights at the $8 level, this type of thing. Now, there was a gap in the chart at that time. It wasn't as dramatic as I just illustrated, but it does exist. If anyone goes back and checks, you'll see there's actually two gaps in the chart. And this is what takes place, you know, and took place again and again and again. I would just call it the game restarting. And again, I'll give Ted Butler some credit here, as he very much deserves, because Ted was really instrumental in waking a lot of people up to the commitment of traders reports. And what you could do with those in the early days is you could almost trade silver to the penny. Now, those days are long, 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 long gone. And not that I advocate trading for anybody. In fact, just the opposite. I think most people should never be in the futures market. I happen to be there myself on a very small basis. In other words, I do what I teach, which is if you have the wherewithal, the funds, and the ability, then you can use a very small, small portion of your overall funds to either use it to speculate, hedge, or that type of thing. But regardless, that's how the market works. I think I beat it to death, Chris, but you can give me some feedback.
Well, so what I got here is you know, this very much fits with my own views. I actually cut my teeth on I was a futures trader for a while for myself, for my own fund, private fund, and did mostly focused on SPX and silver and gold. So I'm very aware of the shenanigans that you talk about, because I watch them happen again and again. And so what I focused on here, though, is you said if the main trend is up, though, these bounces that we're talking about, where a trading fund and a commercial bank, they're involved in some blood sport with each other. They actually, as far as I'm concerned, they don't even care about fundamentals. Fundamentals like what is the industrial use of silver? How much is there? All they care about is where are the books stacked, right? How many people are short? How many are long? It's a game. So the price of silver is volatile, not because of fundamentals for the most part, but because of these games that are going on, particularly in the paper markets.
Absolutely agree 100%. I mean, most guys on the floor don't have a clue if we'd ever run out of silver or what it's used for, any of that stuff. They do exactly as you stated. So, yeah, they could care less. But, of course, the public sees this stuff, and, you know, they get worried that, you know, the commercials know something that the, you know, no one else knows about the true fundamental picture of silver and that kind of thing. The commercials may have some insight into that. The traders basically don't care, and most of the banks really don't either. They're there for one purpose, and that's to make money.
Yeah, well, anybody who still has a lot of faith in the banks at this point, maybe they should start reading some newspapers from starting about 2 years ago. There's just I've lost a lot of faith in these people to do anything other than to have a very, very finely focused sense of what's available today, maybe tomorrow, but next year, not so much. And so they do that game really well. I want to talk now about really where silver is going. And before I get there, you mentioned one word that was very interesting to me. I want to make sure we circle back on it. You mentioned in regards to the silver ETF, SLV, you used the word purportedly. to describe their actual physical silver holdings. Can you flesh that out for me, please?
Absolutely. This is one that's in the controversial area, and I've done a few interviews privately for my mastermind group, but I have little doubt that most of the silver that's on the SLV's website and gives you the bar number is there somewhere. But what I am really concerned about is if it's hypothecated or not, meaning are there more than one owners on that same bar? And I can almost guarantee that there's multiple owners for almost every bar that they report. Doesn't mean that that bar doesn't exist. What it means is that bar might have been it takes 50,000, takes 10 contracts to be a market maker. So I've got 10 contracts, I've got 50,000 ounces, and I ship it to my buddy who's a hedge fund manager over in Idaho. That's my silver. I have just sent it over to him on a lease. I've leased it to him. Now, he's taken that silver and he swapped it with somebody at the SLV. So they've got bars there. And he swapped for those. And now those are on the exchange showing as, you know, part of the deal. So you could have a lease and a swap. So you could have two or three claims on those same bars. And that happens over and over again. So the reason I use purportedly is that's the correct word. I doubt highly that there's very few bars that are actually one-to-one correspondents that are sitting in the SLV and that's their only purpose. That's not the way banks operate. That's not the way the whole system operates. So I am not against the SLV. But I also state very clearly that if you follow what I teach, you wouldn't want that to be considered a primary silver investment. That's a paper investment. That's not silver. That's paper. It only settles in paper. People ask me, well, you think there's going to default on the SLV? I say, how could there be? I mean, read the prospectus. They settle in cash. You think they have any trouble printing that stuff up? I haven't seen any problem with that lately.
Yeah. All right. So they have apparently a lot sitting over there. Is there, when we look at this primary trend, you mentioned that SLV was really a critical component of starting to enforce, I guess, the fundamental trend to the upside. Any concern about them being a catalyst for reversing it, or do you just see investment demand continuing from here? And how does SLV factor into that for you?
Yeah, very good question. I've been asked that before. In fact, I'm so bullish, and I am biased. I think anyone that knows me very well knows that. But I was asked that early on, and it kind of dawned on me. I go, yeah, of course. You know, first of all, some numbers. The SLV has claimed to roughly 300 million ounces of silver. The amount of silver that's held by the dealers on the COMEX is less than 30 million. So in round numbers, the SLV is 10 times bigger than the COMEX. Yet the COMEX is what gets all the attention. Yet in the physical realm, whether the amount of the SLV is held independently of no, you know, without multiple claims, like I'm almost certain that there is, regardless of that fact, they are a huge supplier of silver. So when you get a sell-off, as we had recently, I think it was 35 million ounces came off the SLV, at least by their books, and that, of course, is a large hunk of silver to move around, and it's just like the example I gave earlier, will weight on the market significantly, and it has. Now, whether that physical silver really moved, you know, off of the SLV vaults and somewhere else, I'm not sure. It probably was a paper transaction, but that's, you know, neither here nor there as far as what it actually caused the market to do.
Okay. So here we are, and silver just recently, if we're going to talk about manipulation, we have to talk about the most recent takedown, I guess. So by my eyes, anything that starts at 1:30 in the morning on Sunday and knocks that much off of silver's price is a suspect move in my mind, particularly since most of that knockdown stuck at the first open of the major markets the next morning. What's your views on that particular piece of work there?
Well, my personal view on that is it was so blatantly obvious a blind man could see it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look, when you get a market that's moving that down in such a small volume arena, remember, all prices move up and down, as you know. I'm not lecturing you, Chris, but just for your audience, mm-hmm. That, you know, up and down. So there's some a massive amount of selling in a very, 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 very small market and takes the price down significantly because it's such a teeny market. You can move it very easily. The smaller the market is, the easier you can manipulate it. So now what happens on the open is that the clerks are required by law to start sending out margin calls on everybody that's on the open that's in the margin territory. So this thing starts feeding on itself. And this has got to be orchestrated. I mean, you have to be a moron not to know what's going to take place when you do it. So it really upsets me, as you can tell from my voice. I don't like it. I don't know if there's any way to correct it. I mean, if there was a floor trader that, you know, was bullish silver, had a position protect, which is could have been true, maybe, they might have seen it and seen the order flow being so ridiculously small that, are you kidding me? And, you know, started to buy, you know, on the open, and it might not have happened, you know, where, you know, there was enough time right at the open. I mean, it would have to be pretty quickly to take place, where, you know, you might have prevented some of the damage, but that's not what happened. You almost have to wonder, like, you know, I mean, you have to actually ask the question, is this a total setup or not? I mean, it's like, okay, it's going to happen now, and then, of course, when it opens in the big markets, get ready, boys, get your speed dialers set up, because here we go. Start sending out the margin calls. We're coming for them again.
Mm-hmm. All right, the whole thing looked very suspicious to me because it was thin. The analogy I use is kind of like the price of beef plummeted in Hawaii one evening, and the next morning all of Oklahoma opened up 10% down.
Good analogy. I could, well said. I'll use that one the next time I'm asked about this.
It's silly, right?
It
shouldn't have had any impact at all, really. I mean, it should have been undone, and whoever dumped all that should have lost their shirt.
Yeah. Anyway, you get me excited. You're exactly right. And it's only because these paper markets exist how they exist that this can take place.
Yeah. All right, so let's switch up a bit, though. You mentioned, you know, that you don't recommend anybody should be trading silver, so I think you're an investor in silver. Why is it that you think silver is a good investment? And could somebody Rip Van Winkle silver in your mind? I mean, they buy some, go to sleep, 10 or 20 years later, wake up and feel good about what they've done.
Yeah. Personally, I do both, trading and investing. Mm-hmm. I think I have three levels of service. The main service is for the buy and hold investor, and I think that's the safest for most people. Some people like to trade, and that's fine, and I do a little bit of that myself. As far as the Rip Van Winkle question, that's an excellent question. I was obviously very bullish silver, starting actually a couple times in my life. This is the second bull market for me, but I really got on the bandwagon in actually the late 90s, and then after moving up here, started the website. I had another one earlier, but regardless, I was very bullish on silver from 2000 to 2010 on basically the monetary aspect. Yeah, I looked at the industrial and it was growing and it was important. But after 10 years, I decided to take another look at the silver market from the aspect that I don't know anything about the silver market. So I took out a blank sheet of paper and I asked the question, okay, it's January 2010. Would I want to buy silver for the next 10 years or not? When I got done with that study, I published it in the March issue of the Morgan Report. Is still available for all my members. The paid members can get it. But I've lectured on this for free. So if you really want this information, if you just Google my name, there's several lectures out there that I've gone through pretty much the entire report. Regardless, Chris, what I found was astonishing. What I found was that within 3 to 4 years, we are going to be back in a deficit situation, and most of the silver bugs know what that means, and some of the new listeners might not, but silver basically was in a deficit from 1990 to 2006. For 16 straight years, the amount of mining available and recycling available did not meet total demand. But supply and demand have to meet every year. And so the way it meets is by the above-ground stockpile, I'll call it, of silver. It was 2 billion ounces in 1990. It dwindled down to roughly 500 million by 2006. So round numbers, we were taking 100 million ounces of fine silver out of the stockpile every year to meet the demand for 16 straight years. Mm-hmm. And then around that same time frame, the mining supply had increased and increased from the commodities boom, and we had a crossover, meaning that the mining supply plus recycling does meet total demand currently. That's just on the industrial side, but if you throw in the monetary aspect as well, you have monetary demand that's going to be there, and you're going to have a supply chain that can't meet just the industrial demand. So I am more bullish now, Chris, on silver going out 10 years than I was, as I said, back in the year 2000. I was surprised by this. Now, I want to be very careful here because, number one, whenever you project something 10 years, and I do not do a linear projection, by the way, you're probably going to make some errors. So I was very conservative. I took into account that there are errors to be made. There's things that I'm going to overlook. So I only looked at the three main areas where the most rapid growth in silver exists, and that's in food, water, and solar. So the three things people need the most. They need food, they need to eat, and they need energy. There's a huge push, as everyone knows, for solar energy around the planet. Governments around the globe are looking to push the solar industry. I'm an engineer. Solar is really not that efficient a methodology to make electricity, but it does. But it's being pushed, and when you have it being pushed, it's going to get, you know, a lot of money, and a lot of silver is going to be used in the process. Water purification, very important, obviously. Silver is used there more and more. And lastly, on the food processing, it has packaging as part of it. With the nanotechnology, you can impregnate these plastic sheets with silver now, and you can do a wrapping of a meat or any other product. You could do with potato chips as an example. They don't, but I mean, any packaging you can think of silver impregnated will keep the product from spoiling a lot longer. So it's used mostly in like the meat packing industry, but that's a huge growth industry as well. So those three are the only ones I accounted for in the study. I didn't look at the RFID tags. I didn't look at consumer electronics. I didn't look at, you know, everybody in China buying a flat screen television. I just discounted all that stuff. They still are going to have a problem 3 or 4 years out. Now, the reason I keep saying 3 or 4 is because there's going to be a very significant increase in the amount of silver that comes out of the ground from some significant mines over the next 3 years or so. And I have to be truthful. I mean, that's a fact, and let's stick to the facts. Mm-hmm. So there may be a lot of the mainstream press or the mainstream financial press telling everybody how much new silver is coming to the market. And they will probably be accurate on their numbers. What they're not telling you is that that's going to last for just a few more years. And if everything goes as I expect it to, meaning in a very strong recessionary environment, there's still going to be huge industrial demand for silver, and there's also going to be monetary or investment demand. I think silver is one of the most easy investments you could actually sleep on. Now, it moves quite rapidly up and down, as we all know, but if you're taking a Rip Van Winkle approach that, you know, I'm putting, you know, X amount of dollars or Aussie dollars or candos into silver, you know, 10 years out, and I'm giving it to my grandkids or for myself or whatever the case may be, and that long-term approach, I can't think of a better investment.
Yeah. All right. So I just noted, I think India's year-over-year demand growth for silver was up a couple 100% this past year, and we're seeing all sorts of demand increasing from industrial sources. One of the things I track very closely is the idea that, yes, there are some fairly significant new mines coming on board, but a lot of silver also comes as a byproduct of other things, zinc, copper mining, other things. And as I look into that space, yeah, there's I see peak oil as being very real. I see energy as being a critical component of mining. And mining costs, and I see the possibility that some marginal mines may not really be economic at these or higher fuel prices. So there's all sorts of factors sort of weighing in on this. Yes, there are more people. Yes, there's more industrial demand. Yes, we are going to be wanting more silver for a variety of purposes. Yes, there's new mines coming on to help meet that. And on the other side of that, we've got this idea that known mines are depleting. Eventually, all mines run out. That's the nature of mining. And the faster they run out faster at higher fuel costs because the marginal production just doesn't cut it. So on a Rip Van Winkle standpoint, when I look at these things, 10 or 20 years, I think we're facing a very different landscape. And so it defaults all the way back to I've got a very simple investment philosophy here. Bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. I prefer physical silver and in this regard. What are your thoughts there?
Well, I've always thought from the beginning it will continue through the, you know, as long as this bull market continues, that number one, you have to buy physical to start your metals portfolio. I basically, if I could, wouldn't let anyone subscribe to my service that didn't, you know, initiate a position in physical silver and or gold before they ever, you know, talked to me, so to speak. I can't control that, of course. But no, it's the only monetary asset outside of what I call the matrix. I mean, everything else, you can have the best mining company in the world, but you still have to buy it through a broker and you still have to sell it through a clearinghouse. Gold and silver, you don't have to clear anywhere. I mean, I come from an aircraft background. I don't talk about this very often. But the survival kit in fighter jets is a gold coin.
Mm-hmm.
They don't care where you parachute over. It could be Vietnam. It could be China. It could be anywhere. Anywhere in the world, that gold coin is recognized as money. And there isn't any clearing problem, is there? You just hand it to somebody, and they know what it is. So that's what gold and silver represent anywhere on the planet. And a lot of people just don't get it. They don't get what value is, what real value money based is, what specie is, what, you know, honest money is all about. A lot of people do. There's a very small percentage. But people don't take for granted that everyone knows what gold is. And yet, you know, ask them, a lot of people in some places have never seen, like, a certain currency or whatever. But that kind of money, gold money, silver money, is recognized everywhere. So I definitely emphasize buying the physical metal first and have it in hand if you're okay with that. If not, have it in a secure location that you have access to and you know it's there. After that's established, then I'm a little looser. I'm pretty free market. So if you wanted to go into some, you know, what I teach is to go into top-tier cash-rich unhedged mining companies. I like big money and big companies.
Mm-hmm.
I'm much more inclined to grow my wealth at 20, 25, 30% a year compounded than to buy every junior mining company out there that's got a story to tell. I'm not really that big on the story stock thing. We've done very well on some of them. I've lost on others. But I teach, you know, bet a little to win a lot. This is speculative money. Make sure it's a speculation. Sometimes people don't do what I teach. I can't, again, control that, but I'm very consistent with what I tell people. Right now, the real sweet spot on the mining side is in the mid-tier sector, and that's where we did so well for the first 10 years. I've kind of refocused the report now to emphasize that sector because that's where the real best risk-to-reward profile lies. But, you know, any of us that write in this sector, you've got to diversify even within the sector. Nothing's more frustrating than buying a mining company and only buying one, and yours goes down while all the, you know, many more are going up.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have a basket. No one is smart enough to give you a stock that's going to do well. You have to diversify throughout the sector. I hate long lists. Diversifying doesn't mean you have to have 100. I think, you know, 10 or so is probably enough to the diversification. Who can track 100 companies? I know I can't.
Right. So we have our physical core portfolio. Even Merrill Lynch says 10% gold exposure is not a bad idea. I'm personally much higher than that. Everybody has to make their own sort of decision around that. And then after that, you recommend and track and offer a service around looking at how you can leverage your investments in the market. So David, if people wanted to find out more about you and your service, where would they go?
Well, there's a couple ways to get there. The easiest is the domain name, themorganreport.com. It's all one word, themorganreport.com. You can also go to silver-investor.com. Both take you to the same place.
Great. And you have your offerings, your subscription service. People can find out more.
Right. It's a it's a two-purpose website. Tons of information for free. Don't feel obligated to subscribe. You get on the free email list if you want. I give good information on that for free every week. And then if you're a serious investor and you want to, you know, get my best thinking, you can try a subscription.
Excellent. So how's the Silver Summit 2011 shaping up?
Quite well, thank you, and we're not afraid to, you know, cover both sides. I mean, Jeff Christian and I call us friends in quotation marks.
Uh-huh.
We certainly don't agree on everything, but, you know, Jeff's invited every year, and I think it's good for people to hear both sides. I'm not a, you know, I'm not a know-it-all. I try to be a learn-it-all.
Mm-hmm.
I read a lot of stuff that I am opposed to, but I think it keeps my mind sharp, and I like to see, you know, the other side. I try to keep an open mind. I'm skeptical, but with an open mind. I really, my main core proposition is my mission statement, and that revolves around the fact that fiat money has always failed. And if you don't think it's going to fail this time, then, you know, don't listen to this program and have a nice day. If you're concerned, then I think you should get better educated. And, Chris, I think you were one of the leaders in the field as far as educating people. You're broader based than I am. I mean, I'm pretty strong economically, especially on the Austrian school, but, you know, I'm pretty focused on the metals themselves and mining, and that's, you know, keeps you quite busy every day. But you've got, you know, a broader base looking at the oil situation, and I, coming back to what you said earlier, totally agree. I mean, I think you're not going to see the increased compounding 2 to 3% in the silver market that we've seen over the last 8 years continue because of the energy situation. But I projected my analysis as if it would. In other words, to be conservative, I pretended as if we could keep mining at a 3% growth rate compounded for the next decade. I really, really doubt that's the case.
Right. So, well, thank you for the kind words, and it's been a pleasure talking with you today. I hope we get to do it again.
Well, my pleasure, anytime.
All right. Thank you very much, David.
You're welcome.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartinson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.